Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Crime Beat this evening is delighted to announce the appearance of Ed Falco, author of the best-selling book titled Family Corleone, an exhilarating and profound novel of tradition and violence, of loyalty and betrayal. The Family Corleone will appeal to the legions of fans who can't get enough of The Godfather. On the second half of the program, Crime Beat brings you John Land, author of Strong Vengeance. The book is a gripping account of Texas Ranger Caitlin Strong, who finds herself investigating the mass murder of an offshore oil rig crew. The narrative doesn't stop there as she uncovers a devastating terrorist attack about to be launched on the United States. It's going to be a great show. More about these guests in just a few minutes. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director-publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh, Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist in Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown as well, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology on influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out early 2003, and he's publishing another book with Ellie Warner, another best-selling author, a book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks, Ronnie. That's great. Much appreciated. Well, you know, our book is sold out right now, and it's a great thrill to have that happen. It's going to be coming out in ebook form later this fall. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read the mail we received, I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the globe for tuning into Crime Beat. You know, there's no turning back the clock now, Ron. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. A couple not too keen on the program, but we'll take the good with the bad. You know, we're averaging over 135,000 listeners every week, and it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony for making this show possible. Like I said many times, Ronnie, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, here's this week's mailbag. We'll have one this time around. Now, this one is from Vladik of New Jersey. Vladik writes, being of Ukrainian heritage, I remember my grandfather, who was about 10 years old during the Holodomor, telling us about the horrible famine that resulted during that time in 1932-1933. It's about time that the world recognized the mass murder perpetrated on the Ukrainian people by that monster, Joseph Stalin. Wow, Ronnie, wow. Any comments?
Yeah, it's you know, I didn't learn about that, being Ukrainian myself, until I was in my teens, you know, and started to go to university and reading about it and realizing that Joseph Stalin was as bad as Adolf Hitler. And, you know, for the Ukrainian people, Joseph Stalin has a reputation that Bin Laden has for the American people. So, yeah, it's very true. It was an eye-opening segment last week with the directors of that incredible documentary about the Holodomor, which is sort of the Holocaust of the Ukrainian people.
Yeah, well, Genocide Revealed is what it's called, and I urge all of you out there, all our listeners out there, to get the DVD. It's a very intriguing and fascinating look at what happened during that horrible time. Now, Ronnie, let's see what's our show all about next week. Give us a shot at that.
Great. We have a former guest that was one of the leading psychiatrists in the world. He's going to give his take on the mind of Anders Breivik, the mass murderer in Norway. The trial is still going on, believe it or not. There's been absolutely no coverage here in the U.S.
It's amazing.
So he's going to be talking about that. We also got Elisa Stateman and Bree Tate, who are going to talk about their book, Restless Souls, which gives the Sharon Tate family account of what happened after Sharon Tate was murdered by the Manson family and their crusade for justice. So we're going to be talking about that. Two interesting segments next week.
Yeah, it's going to be a darn good show, that's for sure, with those guests. Well, Ronnie, tell us what you're up to in the next few weeks. Where are you going, and what are you going to be doing?
Well, I'm trying to stay home. It's too hot to go anywhere, right? But I'll be on Saturday on Margaret McLean's NBC program in Boston. It's a crime radio show to talk about Frank Matthews, his life and the mystery of his disappearance. I'll be on at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So any of our listeners want to tune in, they could tune in to itsacrimeradio.com for that show. And it's streamed live, so I'll be on for an hour. And it should be an interesting segment.
I wish you luck there, Ronnie. You luck. You're gonna really be a dynamite performer.
Willie, I don't need luck. I need money.
We all need money.
How many times have I got to tell you that?
Okay, get a real job, man.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Believe me, I'm working on it.
Good for you. Now, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is this week's rap sheet. Dateline, July 10th, 2012. Jerusalem. Yasser Arafat's remains to be exhumed. Palestinians seek evidence of poisoning. The Iranian-Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has given final approval to dig up Yasser Arafat's remains and is also pressing for an international investigation of his predecessor's mysterious 2004 death. I'll tell you, Ronnie, you're pretty close to this story. You interviewed this guy.
Yeah, I interviewed Arafat in 97. This is a tale from the dark side, I'll tell you. I mean, Arafat was sick in 97 when I saw him. He trembled like crazy. And I ended up interviewing him. I had about 35 minutes with him, and I realized why the Palestinians were always getting the short end on the PR aspect of the Middle East conflicts because his English was so bad. Yeah. And, so it was very interesting. But, you know, they're trying to pin the thing on the Israelis. But, you know, why would the Israelis, want to kill him? They had him boxed in, locked in, and so there's no need to kill him. So it's going to be an interesting when they exhume this his body to find to see what they find out about what happened to him.
Yeah, well, with the technology they have today, Ron, if there is any evidence there, they're going to find it pretty quick, I'll tell you.
Right.
Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that story.
Right.
Now, just before we get on with our first featured guest tonight, Mr. Ed Falco, author of Family Corleone, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Shepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you, and we'll try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's first guest tonight is Ed Falco, who wrote Family Corleone. For all you out there who can't get enough of The Godfather, Ed Falco brings you one of this year's major literary hits. This book is a great read. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Ed Falco.
Hey, Ron. Nice to be here.
Great. I did my research, and you've got a really interesting background, and Willie referred to The Godfather as a literary hit. for most of your career, you've been a literary person. Is this a literary hit?
I like to think it's a literary novel, but, you know, I took on this project knowing that I was writing a popular novel, and that my first responsibility was to write a novel that people really wanted to read. So I hope it's an engaging, entertaining, and page-turning novel, but I think it also has some of the depth of character and theme that one associates with literary writing.
Right. Well, you know, you've published experimental novels. You've published a lot of short stories, award-winning short stories. You have you're a very respected writer. Was it hard making a transition to writing popular?
No, not at all. Actually, I was amazed at how easily this I fell into this novel. I did everything different with this novel. I worked from an outline, which I had never done before, and I worked with Mario Puzo's characters, somebody else's characters, something I had never done before. And actually, I found that I really liked this. I really the process was fun. I wrote the novel fairly quickly. Not because it was easy, but because it came kind of naturally to me.
Right. I guess you like the money that comes with it too, right?
I read
a couple interviews with you, and you were lamenting the fact that you know your books weren't often in the bookstores because you know you had a very select audience, and you lamented that you were hoping that you could broaden your audience. But I guess right now you've really broadened your audience, right?
Yeah, I think we've got 50,000 copies in print in the first 5-6 weeks, so that's pretty good. And it's probably more than all the rest of my books combined.
Right. What has been the reaction from, especially your colleagues? You know, I come from an academic environment, and you know, I used to do a lot of freelance writing, you know, writing for magazines like Playboy and stuff like that, which didn't sit well with some of my colleagues. How about you?
Well, the ones that are talking to me are being very friendly and very supportive. I don't know what they're saying when I'm not around. But, you know, I've published in Playboy, too. I've published 3 stories in Playboy,
right.
and I have some commercial writing in my background, too.
Right. Well, our listeners should know that your niece is Edie Falco, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
The famous, she plays Carmela Soprano.
Right.
One of the greatest dramas of all time on TV, The Sopranos. And what does she think about it?
I just heard from her recently. She said she read it and she loved it. Of course, I'm her uncle, so I don't know what else she would say.
Probably. It just give you a clean bill of a laudatory remarks.
Right. I think she's pretty honest with me. I think she liked the book.
Right. Well, you know, you explained your background, and I gave a little bit more on it. Why were you chosen to write this book? Because it seems like a very important book in terms of the Godfather dynasty, you know, mm-hmm. the franchise. And, you know, there are a lot of writers out there that have written popular fiction. How did you get this gig?
Well, luck, mostly. My agent is Neil Olson, who's also the agent for the Puzo family, and he was Mario Puzo's agent. So when the Puzos...
He couldn't make him a deal he couldn't refuse, right?
right. Actually, he offered me this. You know, when they first were doing the sequels to the novel, he called and asked me if I would like to consider doing one of the sequels. And at that point, I was writing another novel and doing other things, and I declined to be considered. I won't say that he offered me the novel and I didn't do it. He offered me the chance to be considered for the novel, and I declined that because I was doing other things. But this time around, it was a straight-out offer. It was, do you want to do it? I did. So,
right. Were you a big fan of the Godfather story?
I was a big fan. I was a big fan of the movies. I loved the Godfather 1 and Godfather 2, and I had read Mario Puzo's novel and liked it back in 19. Well, it came out in 69. Mm-hmm. I read it sometime after that, but it was the movies that I thought were fantastic, and I liked the novel.
Right. On that, now, there's a little confusion in the press. I read where it's based on a screenplay, and then there's based on screenplays. What is your novel based on exactly from Puzo, and what did you do to add to it so that there was a coherent, cohesive story?
It's based on about 55 pages of screenplay extracted from unproduced pages in The Godfather 3
mm-hmm.
and pages from The Godfather 4, which was never produced. So what the family found was that they could, that these pages together made a complete story. So they took those pages, and those pages were what they sold to, at that time, 12 Publishing Company. And then they hired me to take those 55 pages and turn them into a 450-page novel.
Right. So that you know, that was even more challenging, right? Because there wasn't a complete project there upon which to draw upon.
Yeah, you know, it was challenging, but some of the hardest things, you know, this, you're a writer, so one of the hardest things to do is to come up with characters that are that people know and people love. And I had those handed to me on a platter, you know, those who were Mario Puzo's great characters of Sonny Corleone and Vito Corleone and Michael and all of these Luca, all of these characters that everybody knew already.
Right.
So I was able to just take those characters and then weave them into a cohesive story. Of course, you know, 55 pages is, it's going to be hard to pump them up to just take the, that story and make a 450-page novel. So I had to invent a whole lot of stuff and weave Mario's storyline into the larger storyline of the novel.
Yeah, I got a quick, one.
Go ahead, Will.
The book, you know, the book takes place in a relatively short period, from the fall of 1933 to the summer of 1935.
Right, and actually the summer is just sort of tacked on. It's actually to the 1933 1934.
Why did you pick that particular era, that particular time frame? Can you give our listeners a sense of that?
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot of stuff happening right around 1933-34. In particular, it's the end of Prohibition, and the story is about how Vito Corleone goes from a relatively small gang, criminal family, to one of the most influential families in New York, and then eventually to one of the most influential families in the nation. And so Prohibition is a moment of change in the criminal world. And what I imagined was that Vito Corleone and his family, because they had businesses that didn't rely entirely on whiskey, and on alcohol, had influence and were able to take that and to expand it into something much bigger. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it's a moment of transition. 1933 to 1934, when Prohibition ends, is a moment of transition in the underworld, and it's the moment when Vito's family explodes into being the really big crime family that it becomes.
Right. Did you have to do a lot of historical research?
Yeah.
In order to, I mean, like on the mafia, for example, you know, to try to put them in the context of mafia history, because you know, there's a lot of people that read these Godfather books that are really knowledgeable about the subject.
Yeah, and one of the things that Mario did is he made everything. He didn't use historical figures. Everything was fictionalized.
Right.
But he also took almost everything from crime history, so that the more I would read through the history of the mafia, and also just through the history of the period, I would see events and bits and pieces of story that he had woven into his fictional narrative. So much of the stuff that happens in The Godfather has some sort of basis in crime history.
Right.
You know the famous scene where Clemenza is taking Polly Gatto out to get hit, and Clemenza gets out of the car to relieve himself, and then the guy in the back seat shoots Polly Gatto in the back of the head. That's actually a little bit of crime lore history that happened sometime earlier in Chicago. A whole different set of figures, a whole different set of gangsters. But Mario just took it, and he used it and put it in a different time period. So a lot of the stuff in The Godfather is sort of an amalgam of many other of figures, from the Jewish mobsters to the Italian mobsters.
In terms of Vito Corleone, is there any character in real mafia history that he is sort of remind you of?
Well, he's a combination. He's certainly got some Joe Bonanno in him, and he's got some the guy that worked with all the Jewish mobsters. Lucky Luciano. He's got a lot of Lucky Luciano.
Right.
So I think he's got, you know, some of the multiple figures that are sort of merged in him as a crime figure.
Right. When you were writing did you feel like Mario Puzo was looking over your shoulder, making sure that you were getting it right? Wasn't there a challenge there that you have to sort of? Did you have to? Were you required to keep like sort of his voice and his tone for the Godfather book?
Not really. I read all of his books, and I had read them. I read them all relatively close together, so I had a sense of him as a writer. Going into the project, but I write very differently than him, and he has an expository kind of talky
right.
style of writing that people love.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I could do that, and so I wrote in a more scenic style than I think Puzo would have. But I kept his themes and his approaches, and I like to think that this novel. I mean, my goal all the way through this was to write a novel that felt like it actually really did exist before the movie
right.
and the novel. So that if you read it,
yeah.
you feel like you know those characters better when you see the movies or read
right.
the novel.
Yeah, I would think that it would be harder to go back in history than to go forward, right, in terms of writing? Is that more challenging for you as a writer?
I've never tried a prequel or a sequel before,
yeah.
so it's all
right.
it's all new. The advantage of the prequel was that I had all the great characters to work with. I had Vito
right.
and Sonny. Whereas the sequels, if you pick up after the movies, they're all dead. You know, the only guy you've got left, you only have Michael left.
Right.
So I think the magic of The Godfather is the family, is Vito and Sonny and Michael and Fredo and Connie
right.
and the people that work for them. You know, that's the the magic that draws us to it.
Right.
So I think the prequel had an advantage in that I could have the whole family back again.
Right. Well, you know, we've seen these movies like 10, 20 times, like Willie and I, and I know a lot of other people. Did you have the image of the actors in your mind? Because every time I think of Sonny, you know, I think of James Caan, you know, and this ballistic guy
yeah.
running around. You think of Michael, Al Pacino and all that. And did you have those characters? I mean, were you thinking when you were writing these characters, did you have the actual actors that were playing the characters in the movie?
Well, I think
mind?
That, you know, I think it's kind of complex in that the movie characters are drawing from Mario Puzo's book characters.
Mm-hmm.
So that, yeah, absolutely, I've got James Caan and John Cavall and mm-hmm. Al Pacino and Robert Duvall in my head when I'm writing. But Robert Duvall and Pacino and Cavall, they had Mario Puzo in their head when they were interpreting these characters. So it was both Mario and the actors, I think, mm-hmm. that were in my mind when I was writing these characters.
Right. Well, you have a day job at the university. How long did it take you to do the novel?
Well, as I said a moment earlier, I did everything different. My ordinary routine is to write a couple of hours in the morning, and then I spend the rest of the day mm-hmm. doing the rest of my work.
Right.
But this novel, I put in 8 and 10 hour days all summer. So mm-hmm. I started in May, and by the time I went back to school in August, I had most of a draft done. But I was writing, you know, I was putting in full. I say 8 or 10, but sometimes I'd write all day and into the evening.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Let's take a break, Willie, and we'll be back with our fascinating guest, Ed Falkel.
You bet. We'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib, and we're coming back to Ed Falkel, a fascinating, fascinating interview. Back to you, Ron.
Right. Ed Falkel, author of The Family Corleone, fast becoming a real bestseller. And there's a couple of websites you could check out, www.edfalkel.us and www.thefamilycorleone.com. We have a lot of international listeners. We're in over 120 countries. Ed, is your book available internationally?
It is. I think it's available in some 20 countries, most of Western Europe, Italy,
right.
France, Lithuania, Vietnam, China. It's
right,
available.
Right.
It's available
right.
just
so
everywhere.
It's spreading across the world, and you know, The Godfather is an international phenomenon. So I'm sure it'll reach a lot of the countries that the people that are listening to the show, right?
Yeah, I enjoyed the. So far, I've seen the German and the English editions of it, and. The German edition is kind of fun because the translations are so different, you know.
Right.
But it's been fun to look at.
By the way, Ed, you've got a great glossary of terms, of Italian terms in the back of that book here. You help
thank you.
With the read, I'm telling you, man.
Right.
That was actually a fun part of writing the book, is that, you know, like a lot of Italian youth in my generation, I grew up with parents who wouldn't speak Italian around us.
Uh-huh.
They wanted us to learn only English. That was their idea of completely assimilating. But they did have fights around us. When they had fights, they used all of those words that are in the glossary. So I heard all of those words, which are mostly exclamations and curses.
Right.
And I heard them, but there's a big difference between hearing something and figuring out how it's spelled and what it actually means. My father used to call me a jadrul all the time. It's a jadrul, grow here. And I heard that as J, you know, as a J sound. Turns out it means cucumber. It's a kind of endearing term for stupid.
Well, you mentioned Luca Brasi, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And, this guy is a real animal, and he's, you know, devil in car. Where'd you come up with this character? You reminds me a little bit of the Iceman, you know, the Kulinski character. We had one author did the book on him. But did you base this on a real character, or did you make him up?
Some of the stuff that Luca Brasi does comes from other Crimeland figures. For instance, that really gruesome scene where he blindfolds a guy and blinds him.
Right.
That was Vincent Kahl. You know, he did that supposedly when he was working for Dutch Schultz. I came across that in my research.
Oh, so it's based on a real incident, yeah?
Yeah, it's based on a real incident. And most of the violence in the book is based on real incidents.
Right.
And the really horrific scene with the baby in the furnace, that of course comes from The Godfather itself.
Right. Well, you know, that was one of the criticisms. You know, that there aren't many, because your book's been well received, but mm-hmm. they're saying that the scenes of infanticide and you have the decapitation scene, you know, go a little bit too much, go a little bit too far. What do you say to that?
Well, I didn't put a horse head in anybody's bed.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the Godfather is a violent book, and and if I'm trying to write a book that Mario did, that's like the book that Mario wrote, then I think that kind of violence is part of the story. Plus, I'm writing about a really violent period in American history. I mean, Prohibition was a bloody, violent period, and those kinds of things happened.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching news reports on the violence in Chicago this last week. You know, they have more murders in Chicago than they've had in any year previous. And you know, I feel like I'm reading about the 1930s again. You know, I feel like I'm reading about gang violence on the streets of New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ed, I've got a loaded question here.
Yeah,
for you.
Sure.
Why should we be romanticizing The Godfather? They were homicidal thugs. I mean, they were the worst of the worst.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and a number of critics have posed that very same question. For the Washington Post reviewed the book and said, you know, I think it's a good book, but we shouldn't be romanticizing violence. And my answer is that I don't think I'm romanticizing violence. If you look at what Vito Corleone wanted, which is that he wanted to create a life for his children that was respectable, that was safe, and that was affluent, he achieved none of that. What he achieved was the destruction of his family. The death of Sonny, the moral and spiritual death of Michael, the death of Fredo, the moral ruin of Connie. If you look at what happens, this isn't romantic. It's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if you read the book and you see what's happened to Sonny and to his family, you don't say to yourself, gee, that looks like fun.
Right.
You should say, I think somebody's made a terrible mistake here.
Right. Now, I imagine out there are people that probably say, who's the Godfather?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's got to be somebody in the world. Do you have to be familiar with the Godfather story to appreciate your book? My question is, does it stand alone? Like, just as a, you know, or do you have to be constantly referring your mind to, you know, the Godfather story?
I tried very hard to write a book that a generation of readers who never heard of The Godfather would read and like. So as far as I'm concerned, these characters are created whole, as if they were created from whole cloth. You don't have to know anything about the movies or the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, one critic said you need to be familiar with the movie, and then another critic sort of repeated almost word for word what he said.
Right.
But I heartily disagree. I think you can read this book without knowing anything about The Godfather.
Right. As being a fellow writer, all I can say about critics, the hell with them, right?
They do drive you crazy, don't they?
Yeah, right, right. I mean, you'll go nuts if you take we'll compare them and all that. But has the book been optioned for a movie? I mean, are we going to be seeing Godfather 4?
I hope so. But I want to back up one moment and say that the question of violence, we pointed out that some critics said that the book was too violent. Another critic said that the book doesn't equal the violence of The Godfather. So, who do I listen to? As far as the movie goes, the Puzo family and Paramount are officially in court negotiating the rights to the book. The Paramount feels that they owned all of the rights,
right.
And the Puzo family owns that they own the literary rights, and that Paramount has the dramatic rights. So they're kind of hashing that out. I sincerely hope they're going to get that hashed out by the end of before the summer's over.
Right.
And then I hope that Paramount makes a movie. But I, that's
like
every writer in the world. I hope that.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. If the movie comes out, we want you back on the show, and keep us informed of what you're doing, because you're a great guest, and we appreciate you coming on our show and talking about the family Corleone.
I enjoyed
the. Thank you, Ed, and we'll see you soon. And again, The Family Corleone by Ed Falco. And you can go to a couple of websites, thefamilycorleone.com and Ed Falco, F-A-L-C-O dot U-S. And it's rapidly making its way around the world for you listeners out there in other parts of the world other than the United States. Thank you, Ed.
All right. Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Will.
Okay.
Well,
great guess. Let's take a break.
We needed a good 2.5 hours and 3 hours.
Right.
Thank
right.
you very much.
Great question.
Ed, again.
Okay.
Now, just before we get on to our second segment of our show, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. While our production staff hooks up with John Land for the second half of our program, we'll hand it over to Corey of Artist First World Radio for some brief remarks.
Crime Beat executive producer Ron Chepsik is not only a co-host of the show, he's also a crime writer and a publisher of other talented writers as well. Go to the publisher's website at strategicmediabooks.com to check these popular books out. Ron's books include the award-winning Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, which has been optioned for a movie, Queenpins, the first book exclusively about women gangsters, The Traficantes, Godfathers from Tampa, Florida, The Mafia, The CIA, and The JFK Assassination. You can also buy books by such noted true crime authors such as Pat O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, Scott Deitch, author of Rogue Mobster, Scott Wilson, author of Straight from the Hood, and Seth Ferranti, author of Prison Stories. Keep up with the new books coming out by joining the company's hot new mailing list. To get on it, email strategicmediabooks@gmail.com. That's STRATEGIC mediabooks@gmail.com. The books from Strategic Media Books are also available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and through your favorite bookstore. When you go to Strategic Media Books' website, mention that you caught the buzz from the Crime Beat radio show and you will get $3 off any purchase. Again, the website is StrategicMediaBooks.com, STRATEGIC MediaBooks.com. Come on down and you won't be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Thanks, Corey. Tonight, on our second half of our program, we bring you popular crime fiction writer, Mr. John Land, author of the recently released book titled Strong Vengeance. What a book. It's a barn burner, turn pager, you name it. So stick around. You won't want to miss this interview. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, John Land.
Hey, Ron, how you doing?
Hey, man. Is your book out now? Is it out?
It's starting to show up now. The official pub date is July 17th.
Great. We got you before the big rush.
You got
with all
me
the
first.
Pressure.
No one has talked to me yet, so you have the exclusive, and there's news to
come. Oh, wow. That's really fantastic on that. Let's start off by talking about what your book's about. It's called Strong Vengeance.
It is.
And it deals with a recurring character, Caitlin Strong, and you take it from there.
Caitlin Strong's a female Texas Ranger. This is her fourth adventure, but all the books are meant to be read individually, so you don't have to read them in order. Each one is independent.
Right.
And in this one, Caitlin is on the trail of Islamic homegrown terrorists.
Wow. Wow. And she's a Texas Ranger, right?
Yes, she is.
And that is very interesting. And she's female. Why did you choose a female character? Because you've written several books. That's kind of risky, you know, being a writer myself.
You know,
to write,
Ron,
about the opposite sex.
It's risky, but actually, Caitlin was born at a marketing meeting. I should call it a sales meeting. We have once a year a meeting at my publisher where we meet.
Right.
I get to meet the sales force and my publisher, and we sit down and talk about trends and things that are happening in the industry and what I should be doing. And
right.
One of the things that came up at a meeting about 5 years ago was the fact that thrillers are by far the most popular genre, and most books are bought by women. But there was not one female thriller hero.
Wow.
There were plenty of mystery female heroes.
Uh-huh.
But there wasn't a female Jack Reacher, a female
right.
James Bond. No one was doing that. So I said, wait a minute, why don't I try it? And I'd always wanted to write about the Texas Rangers. So it was kind of a light bulb goes off in your head like three times in your life, in your career, that
right.
you're lucky enough to have.
Uh-huh.
And I said, a female Texas Ranger. And that gave birth to Caitlin Strong.
Wow, that is really interesting. Now, describe her as a character. What are some of the things that make her?
Wow,
make her
you know something?
Up?
It's funny. I've been asked so many questions about Caitlin. I've never been asked that question. She is extremely flawed in that I define her by the fact that she's not perfect.
Uh-huh.
She's basically an old-time gunfighter.
Uh-huh.
You know, even though these books are set in modern times, in the present, they're basically the format is old westerns. And
right, she's a fifth-generation Texan, right?
They're fifth-generation Texas Ranger. Her grandfather, father, who you meet in subplots in Strong Vengeance, in a subplot in Strong Vengeance that deals with Jean Lafitte's long-lost, infamous treasure, legendary treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Caitlin is a character who's done some bad things in her past, who's forever trying to fulfill the legacy of her family and live up to being the first female Texas Ranger. She is just a wonderful character because she's human. She's not perfect. She's not indestructible. She makes mistakes. She has flaws. And that's what makes her so much fun to write and I hope to read.
Right. Sounds like a lot of women I know.
I think she's the kind of woman that if you met in a bar, you might run from. Because
right.
She's too
well, did you meet characters in a bar that you based her on? I mean, how'd you come up with this character?
Great question. I think I've met some of my greatest inspiration has come from bars, in fact. I didn't base her on anything. I based her on my conception. I'm a longtime fan of Westerns
right.
and a longtime kind of connoisseur of the history and lore and legend of the Texas Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really not based on a single individual. She's kind of a composite creature of Texas Ranger persona. And the thing about the Texas Rangers is they were founded in 1823 as arguably the most famous law enforcement division or group in the entire in the history of the United States. And yet, if you look at them today, they're pretty much still doing the same thing they did in 1823 when they were founded, except for the fact that they ride cars instead of horses.
Uh-huh.
So the key for me in this series and in Strong Vengeance was to cast Caitlin as being true to that tradition while bringing in the modern sensibility and the flaws and emotions of a woman. Because here's the challenge, Ron. The challenge is, although she has this gunfighter mentality, she's still a woman. And she has this, you know, this maternal instinct, and she's very feminine, she's very attractive. And one of the great points of the book is her relationship with an outlaw, a former Texas outlaw named Fort Wesley Masters, who has two teenage sons that Caitlin becomes the surrogate mother for. And why I love this and why I like writing this is the fact that there's a constant push and pull. The push being Caitlin as this modern-day gunfighter upholding the law and preserving justice versus the pull of her desire to be the mother of these two boys who she's basically fallen in love with and wants to take care of. And the thing, one of my favorite parts about Strong Vengeance, the fourth and latest in the series, is the book opens with her lover, Court Wesley, in jail, in prison in Mexico, which forces her to move into his home and become the actual mother, the surrogate parent of his sons, Luke and Dylan. And I think some of the scenes that we have between her and those two boys are the strongest in the book, the strongest in the series, and the scenes where the most of her character, the best of her character, comes through.
Right. Does it follow that most of your readers are women?
You know,
because you have such a strong character?
Another great question. I have to say that's a brilliant question because I've grown up as an action-adventure writer where most of my writers were men. Most of my readers were men.
Right.
But the industry has evolved over the years where the vast majority of people who buy books are women.
Right.
So if you're going to be successful in this business today, women have to appreciate you. So the challenge you've illuminated, Ron, is the fact that not only must I try to cultivate the new audience of females who haven't always read me as much as I wish they had in the past, I have to maintain my audience of male readership. And here's the challenge. Will men accept a female hero?
Right.
And will women accept a man writing a female hero? And that is a question that has kind of been answered by the success Caitlin has encountered, but she still hasn't made it to the New York Times bestseller list, so the jury is still out.
Right, right. But you're building an audience, as we say, writers say, right?
I hope so. Will, is that you?
Yeah.
No, that's me.
I thought it was. Is it Will or Ron?
That's Ron.
Will. It's Ron.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I'm trying to make sure I get your voices right. I asked the wrong thing.
You asked me twice, and I can only answer once. So
I forget. But anyway, yes, and that's the challenge. I mean, build an audience. You just said the magic words in the publishing industry. Very few authors, we always hear about the overnight successes.
Yeah. Right.
You know, 50 shades of whatever color that is, gray or green or blue or whatever it is.
Right.
But the fact is, the vast majority of successes in this business are not. It's kind of like it took me 20 years to be an overnight success.
Right.
It's a slow build. And as writers, you know, we keep redefining our creativity in search of the character that strikes us in the way that allows us to reach the mass audience. And the best example, the example I love to use with this is a great friend of mine. That's Lee Child, the great Jack Reacher novels. You know, I look at Caitlin as a female Jack Reacher. She's not a mystery hero. She kills and guns down far too many people in each book. But you know what? I write action thrillers.
Right.
And people who read me, whether they be men or women, know a few things when they get started. They're going to get a book they can't put down, a book that has a tremendous amount of action, but also has the kind of themes and character development. Because here's the thing, Ron. For me, in a book where the character is the same person at the end as they were at the beginning, whether they be a male or a female, that book has failed. Because there must be evolution of the character, even in a series. The character must evolve. The wonderful thing about Caitlin is just what I said before about this constant push and pull. We always see men cast in the traditional role of the loner hero standing up to save the country, the state, the world, whatever it may be. We very seldom see a female standing up to do that very same thing. And that's what Caitlin Strong does in all of the entries in the Strong books. I think Strong Vengeance does it better than any of the others because the threat of homegrown terrorism is greater than any of the threats I've confronted the country with before.
Well, we're going to talk about that if we take a break, Willie. Let's take a break when we come back with this fascinating interview.
You bet, Ronnie. We'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Hrib. Now back to our very, very interesting guest, John Land.
Thank you, Willie. John Land, the author of Strong Vengeance, which has just been released, and we feel honored. This is John's first interview regarding the book. And, John, is there a website our listeners can go to learn more information about you and Caitlin Strong and your books?
Absolutely, johnlandbooks.com, and you'll get all kinds of propaganda about Caitlin. Not very objective, I have to admit.
Right. Now, we have a lot of international listeners. Your book will be sold abroad as well. You'll have access to it?
Yes, it will. It will be sold. I'm published in a number of languages. And the great thing is, because of Amazon, the book is available everywhere. I mean, anyone who's, you know, anyone right now who can read English can get it. Obviously, if you speak a different language or read a different language, it's going to take a little longer to be translated. Mm-hmm. But it will appear somewhere. It will appear everywhere eventually.
Right, right. And, of course, you've got, from what I read, you read 25 books. I read you've done 30 books. You got somewhere.
No, something I lose count myself. But for your international listeners, one of the things I love about this book is terrorism isn't just, you know, an enemy, a foe, an antagonist that appeals or is relevant to American readers. It's obviously relevant the world over.
Right.
John, have you written nonfiction a lot?
I've done one nonfiction book. I did a terrific book that I absolutely love called Betrayal, which you guys, you know,
we were on the show about. With Robert Fitzpatrick.
With Robert Fitzpatrick, and you know something?
Right. Yeah.
The great experience of that, what I learned so much from that, in that it taught me, and this is crazy, I've never said this to anyone, so this is great that we're doing this on the show, that sometimes the villains of reality are actually a lot more worse and a lot more heinous than even the villains that I create. You know something, Ron? Is there a worse villain in the world than Jerry Sandusky?
Is there a worse villain about him in the world
than the priests who obviously I don't even need to go on from there. But here's the thing. In Betrayal, I dealt with corruption and cover-up and, you know, the betrayal by the greatest crime-fighting organization in the world, the FBI, against the people it was beholden to. And one of the things that taught me about the Caitlin Strong series is, and I talk about this a lot when I appear to give speeches, I compare Caitlin Strong to Robert Fitzpatrick. And what has amazed me no end is how similar Caitlin Strong, who is totally made up in my mind, is to Robert Fitzpatrick, who actually lived through an era where he fought heroically to bring down the worst gangster, arguably, of the entire modern era, and that includes John Gotti, and ultimately sacrificed his career. Here's the point. Great heroes in both fact and fiction make great sacrifices and give up a tremendous amount. They relinquish control of their entire lives to become the people who are upholding justice. I know that sounds like a cliche, but anyone who's read Betrayal or anyone who heard that interview, the great interview you guys did about Betrayal, understands that that's exactly what Robert Fitzpatrick did in real life in trying to bring down a horrendous, heinous gangster in Boston named Whitey Bulger and stop the corruption, which was actually rampant throughout the nation, all of the United States. But it's also exactly what Caitlin Strong, who was totally made up, stands for. And I've learned so much from that fact. And it was Truman Capote, Ron, who coined the phrase the nonfiction novel. I kind of understood that when I wrote Betrayal. But I didn't fully understand it until I then followed it up with Strong Vengeance. Because it made me realize that the line between fact and fiction is much thinner than I ever realized before.
That's right. Now, your book's kind of scary. I mean,
why?
Massive dirty bomb.
Oof.
disposed of, nuclear, you know, waste material. Is that a possibility?
You know, Ron, I'm so, you know what? It's like you are not just a great interviewer. You are like a psychic. Because here is what only I've realized recently.
Right.
There is a billionaire. Now, one of the reason why this dirty bomb, this giant...
It's a billionaire.
It's a giant radiological bomb. One of the biggest problems facing the free world, not just America.
Right.
Any country that has nuclear power, what do you do with the nuclear waste?
Mm-hmm.
For years, it was dumped off San Francisco in the water. You can't do that anymore. It's illegal.
Right.
So I conceived in strong vengeance of a character, a waste management mogul, a waste management magnate, who was, his plan was to make hundreds of millions of dollars by bringing in all the radioactive waste in the United States and storing it in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out, and this is the answer to your question, there is a multi-billionaire in West Texas named Simmons. I can't remember his first name. He's real. I'm mentioning his name now. If he wants to sue me, let him.
Mm-hmm.
He is spending millions of dollars to promote conservative causes to relax EPA regulations so he can get permission to bring vast amounts of radioactive waste to store in West Texas. In other words, the fictional character I created in Strong Vengeance, whose name is Teofilo Braga, exists. His real name is Simmons. He's out there. And he's trying to do the very same thing that Braga is trying to do in Strong Vengeance, which allows the terrorists the opportunity to steal all this radioactive waste and blow it up. If you blow all this radioactive waste up at once, the consequences would be unfathomable.
Unbelievable.
And that's what the plot is in Strong Vengeance.
So what is the government, our government, Uncle Sam, doing about this? Are they
concerned? Right now they're doing quite a bit. The EPA prohibits the storage of radioactive waste.
Right, but it's under tremendous pressure to to relax regulations.
And
you know,
this is the problem. I hate to show my colors here, but I have no choice. You've given me no choice, Ron.
So you could perfectly do that on our show.
If Romney gets in and and relaxes these regulations and basically emasculates the EPA, everything that I'm saying could happen, everything that happens in Strong Vengeance, if you create a massive nuclear waste dump where you have 50,000 metric tons, that's not an exaggeration, I believe it's 50,000 metric tons of nuclear waste. It's approximate. It's an incredible amount of these barrels, these 50-gallon drums. If you do that and terrorists infiltrate it and blow it up, it's the end of the United States as we know it.
Wow. And there's not going to be a Caitlin Strong around, right, to save the world.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, again, it's not a question, it's a statement, but it's a great point. The beauty of thrillers from the time of Homer, and that was, the Odyssey was the first thriller,
right,
is to create heroes capable of protecting, you know, the original American heroes protected the frontier.
Yeah.
Now, the modern-day thriller hero, the characters of Vince Flynn, Steve Berry, James Rollins, the great Jack Reacher, who I already mentioned from Lee Child, they protect us. And you're absolutely right. I like to think there are Caitlin Strongs out there.
Now, what are you going to say?
Well, Willie, we only got like a minute, Willie, so we're going to have to close it down. So go ahead, please. We got a minute.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What do you take Caitlin Strong after this great novel you've just written?
Great question. Strong Rain Falling, which will be out next year at this time. It's going to be a tough act to follow, in all honesty. But you will see her even more conflicted. You will see her up against an equally bad villain, evil villain. But in Strong Rain Falling, we're going to take you back to the birth of of Mexican drug dealing, how it all began. All the problems
that's very timely
with that border. I'm going to take you back and show you how it all started.
Right. Well, we're going to have to cut off here. This is really fascinating. I just got one last question. You dedicated your book to Brown football. Does Brown U have a football team?
You know something? I really hope Coach Phil Estes is not listening to this because he's a big guy, and he scares me. But I dedicated it to them because I like to dedicate my books to things that I interest me and involve me,
right.
And that I get involved in my life.
Right.
And I have to tell you, and this is a great segue to finish with, but
right.
Phil Estes, Strong Rain Falling, Book 5 in the Caitlin series that I'm working on now, opens with Caitlin taking Court Wesley Masters' oldest son, Dylan, to visit right. Brown University, where he is a football recruit.
Mm-hmm.
To try to play on the Brown University football team.
Well, we'll leave it there. Because we're going to have to leave you, John. And you've been a great guest again. And we hope to have you back on the program. Keep us informed of what you're doing. And we look forward to chatting with you again. And good luck with your book,
Ron. I've been on your show twice, and I think you guys are the best interviewers in the business. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you, John. You're a great guest. And we appreciate it. Willie?
Yeah, well, thanks, Ronnie, and thanks again to our very special guests, Ed Falco and Mr. John Land. We're delighted to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, great interviews, man. What did you learn about our show tonight?
Well, I learned that I get a big head now. Everybody's
yeah.
always telling us
well,
what a great job.
John calls you brilliant.
Yeah. Well, you know, I appreciate that. A little tongue-tied here and all that. But, yeah, I mean, two great guests. I mean, doing crime fiction in their own way, and they're both successful. I think, you know, Ed Falco, I think the Godfather franchise in good hands. John Land's inspiration to me and a lot of writers. I mean, I just, you know, the guy is, you get on his website and you want to start writing. So we had two great guests again, and hopefully we'll continue with that next show next week, Willie. Willie, how about you?
Well, you know, Ronnie, I learned I better start reading more crime fiction books, man. You know, I never got into much fiction while I was growing up.
Right.
And frankly, going to school, I didn't read fiction that much. But these two books, Family Corleone and Strong Vengeance, certainly sparked my interest in this kind of writing. Great, books, I tell you.
Right. Well, there's just a couple of facts and a couple of misfacts in your thing there. You didn't grow up, Willie.
Yeah, okay, buddy. Okay. I'll get you the next time on that one. Now, okay, buddy. Now, just a reminder for all the listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for July the 19th, where we will feature the return of world-leading forensic psychiatrist Dr. Michael Stone, who will get us in the mind of Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik. Also, Crime News is thrilled to announce the appearance of Alison Statman and Bree Tate, who will talk about their best-selling book titled Restless Souls, the Sharon Tate family's account of stardom, the Manson murders, and a crusade for justice. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one, that's for sure. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly. For all of you out there, you can listen to all our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Good night, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.